So before we get started, I want to actually turn it over to my co-presenter, and I'm going to have the privilege of introducing her. Alexandria Ashraf obtained her Bachelor's of Science degree in Biology from West Virginia University, and she's currently in her second year in her MPH program at the University of Pittsburgh. She's currently applying for medical school, so that's what her hopes are after she gets her MPH. And her research focused at the moment, her practicum is involves ethical considerations of public health practices related to patients with adult onset genetic disorders. That's a mouthful, but here she is.
Good afternoon, everyone. Starting off, I would like to say that we have no personal or commercial interest to disclose at this time. So as some of you may know, Lyme disease is a vector-borne illness caused by a bacteria transmitted by the black-legged tick. The disease is seen in certain geographical regions of the United States, most notably the Northeast and the Upper Midwest. Lyme disease causes a variety of symptoms, and if left untreated, may lead to arthritis and spinal inflammation in the most severe disease stage. The annual incidence of Lyme disease in the United States is about 30,000. However, the true incidence may be underestimated or underreported, as noted in prior research. And while other strategies continue to be investigated, the standard prevention method continues to be education regarding tick checks, as well as the use of insecticide on clothing and the body, and the identification of symptoms at the early disease stage. Yet despite prevention efforts, overall incidence and geographical range continue to increase with time. Looking at the chart here on our left, we can see the rate of Lyme steadily increasing per 100,000 people between the years of 1992 and 2006 in both males and females. And the map over here on the right is spatial breakdown of counties achieving high incidence of Lyme between the years of 1993 and 2012. The county shaded in the black that you see over there are those that achieved high incidence between 1993 and 1997. And going to the lightest gray shades over there, these are the counties that have achieved high incidence rates between 2008 and 2012. Bearing this information in mind, a fundamental question to ask is, what if a model can be used to better predict Lyme disease? Prior research has established associations between temperature and precipitation patterns. Whether it has been through the cases themselves, the primary vector, or the intermediate host. And as you can see, there also have been these associations have their basis in the epidemiological triangle depicted there, where changes in the local environment directly affect the vector. This lays the foundation for a potential model to be created. So going forward, the objectives of this study were to determine the association of historic temperature and precipitation patterns with cases of Lyme in Rhode Island, and also if changes in these patterns are associated with an increase in reported cases. So our methodology of this study began with acquiring data for reported cases of Lyme disease from the Rhode Island Department of Health. These cases include both probable and confirmed disease, and they were collected between the years of 1992 and 2012. And they were organized by county and broken down by the month of symptom onsets. We then obtained historic weather station data from the NCDC for the same locations and the same time frame. And with that, I will turn it over to Benjamin.
All right. So after we obtained the weather station data from the NCDC, we further subdivided it into six-month increments, going back 2 years from the month of report of Lyme disease cases. Now, the rationale for this breakdown in the weather station data is because the primary vector for Lyme disease, the black-legged tick, has a two-year life cycle. So what we're hoping to achieve is to determine in that exact two-year life cycle when is precipitation and weather have the greatest influence on reported cases. And for our analysis, we chose to use a zero-inflated Poisson regression. For those of you who don't know zero-inflated Poisson regression, it's a technique that allows us to account for an excess amount of zeros within the data set. And since Lyme disease does have a very distinct seasonality, there will be an excess amount of zeros in the reported data set, and which I'll go over in a little bit. And we use the zero-inflated Poisson regression, as noted before, to determine the association between Lyme disease and the climate variables themselves, as well as Lyme disease and changes within each climate variable. So before we started, we actually did a little descriptive statistics. So on the chart on the left, we see a breakdown of Lyme disease cases in Rhode Island. And I'd like to point out that one county in particular, Washington, has a disproportionate amount of reported Lyme disease cases. Now this is something to remember, which we'll talk about a little bit in the potential limitations to this study. And then on the right, we also have a reported case of Lyme disease by month. And you can see that the majority of the cases of Lyme disease in Rhode Island were seen between the months of June through August, which reflects upon the seasonality of Lyme disease, and that occurs most often in the summer, as noted in research. And then we decided to actually look at the individual factors themselves. So as you can note, we started with precipitation, and once we did the zero-inflated Poisson regression against each of these factors of precipitation, we found that the majority of them actually do have a significant association with reported cases of Lyme disease. However, the greatest association was seen relatively soon, or right around the half a year mark behind, as well as the precipitation levels around the year behind. As you note, that they also have a positive and a negative association, respectively. Then we decided to model the changes within precipitation and Lyme disease. Now, this was kind of interesting. So what we did is we took all the average of all the Lyme disease cases within the summer months, and then we plotted them against the average precipitation levels in those same months. As you can see, that we do have some relationships, most notably at the half year mark and the 1 year mark, respectively. You can see that there's a greater positive association and negative association with case counts. And this is the actual result table that we pulled up from it. And again, this shows that the relationship at a half a year behind precipitation half a year ago, as well as 1 year ago, had the greatest association with Lyme disease with regards to precipitation. Now moving on to temperature. So we kind of did the same approach for temperature. First, we modeled each individual factor themselves. And when we did this, we saw that the significant relationships were actually seen at temperature of 1.5 years behind. And then also temperature 2 years behind did have a stronger negative association with Lyme disease. And again, once we plotted the changes in time, we saw that the greatest relationships were at 1.5 years and 2 years, respectively. And it was positive and negative, as noted in the result table over here. So what does this all mean? I just threw a bunch of graphs at you, threw a bunch of stuff at you. So what do we can take from this? We can note that the majority of average temperature and precipitation factors were shown to be significant with regards to reported Lyme disease cases. In fact, there was only one factor in both precipitation and temperature that didn't really have a significance in there. And the most significant associations were shown were with precipitation at 1/2 year ago and temperature at 1.5 years ago. So, and with regards to changes over time, the most significant associations, again, were seen when we investigate the factors alone, as we saw with changes in time with each factor. So this confirms that there is an association between temperature and precipitation, at least within Rhode Island. And then also that significant associations were seen with changes in precipitation and temperature in Lyme disease cases in Rhode Island. And then also that the significant associations we found in our analysis confirms what has already been done in the research. And this has been noted in the sources where 0.5 and 2 years ago confirms findings from other researchers. And the association of temperature lagged 1.5 years ago confirms the findings of other studies. And then since the study is only looking at two factors, we can't really base a model just on temperature alone. So this goes into where we want to take this project in the future. And so this is not, I don't want to come off saying that this is a causal relationship, because we have to investigate this further. So what about limitations? So even though we had a really strong amount of cases from Rhode Island, there were some that we had to exclude. These are cases that could not be matched to any particular county. And since we were using county-level weather station data, if you don't have a county, kind of hard to match the cases to some. So we had to exclude around 230 cases from our analysis. The change in surveillance activities for Rhode Island. With conversations with the Rhode Island Department of Health, they noted that around 2004, they changed their views on Lyme disease surveillance. They actually didn't invest much resources in there because they considered it an endemic condition within their state. So if you actually break down the cases even more by year, there's a noticeable drop between 2003 and 2004. And they just wanted to stress that this is actually maybe reflective of an underestimation of the true cases that were happening in Rhode Island at this time. The distribution of the cases in county, as noted in the graph, there was one county that disproportionately had the majority of cases that we analyzed in Washington. So maybe case counts is not exactly the best way to approach this. Maybe we have to take an incidence, an overall incidence, so this is something that we can approach in further analysis. And then approximations. Even though the NCDC has great historic weather and precipitation data, it's not perfect. There are some that are missing. And to accommodate this factor, we had to make some approximations. We assumed that the climate is relatively stable within Rhode Island and there's not drastic changes between counties and within the county itself. So if we were missing a certain month of weather station data or precipitation data, we approximated it by taking all the other weather stations within that county and averaging them out. And if there were significant chunks of weather station data which were missing from counties, in particular one county in Rhode Island didn't really have a lot of good records, we averaged the surrounding counties and for each month, and we averaged those out to determine the weather and precipitation data. And then human error. It's a lot of data entry. You know, we try our best to double check in and triple check it, but we always have to throw that in there because there might be that one cell that we missed up on. So where are we going to take going with this? This is actually where I'm hoping to do my dissertation on. So the next step is to verify these findings by testing for interactions and similar trends in other states as well as other related tick-borne illnesses. So we looked at each factor individually. We didn't really test for an interaction between the factors as well, as saying if you have increased warming at 1 year ago, a half a year ago, and a year and a half ago, would that have a bigger effect? So this is something we really should investigate before making any claims on precipitation or temperature alone. And then, since the black-legged tick also carries a host of other pathogens, most notably babesiosis and anaplasmosis, it would be good to see if we see similar trends within these other diseases. The tests include other factors in the proposed model, ranging from physical environment to behaviors and health of human hosts. As my other colleague presented, that you can use the epidemiological triangle as a model of, you know, to propose a model, such as physical environment, which can affect the vector, as well as the behaviors of the human hosts themselves. Most notably, if someone has pets, they're going to be obviously spending a little bit more time outdoors. So it should be good to incorporate these factors and test them out before actually outlining any proposed model. And once we actually get to the point where we have a model, we have to test it. So this would be good to actually try to predict this in certain states within the Northeast. And then also to determine the cost effectiveness of such a model in comparison to what we already do for tick-borne illnesses and what we have done in the past, such as the Lyme disease vaccine that was discontinued. And to use the nonlinear regression techniques to determine the relationship between changes in climate and Lyme disease incidence in future models. We saw some interesting trends with changes in a particular factor over time. It'll be good to model this out into the future to say, okay, if we see increases in temperature for the next like 20 years, how is this going to estimate affect the Lyme disease potentially? Because as we noticed before, we're seeing that the range is increasing for the black-legged ticks and is subsequently causing more cases of Lyme disease. So these are all of my references. And I would be more than glad, and before we get to questions, I would like to thank Theodore Merrick of the Rhode Island Department of Health. He was instrumental in, you know, getting me the case data that I needed for this, as well as my two other colleagues, Professor Jan Medlock and Professor Jeff Bethel, who couldn't make it here this year. Any questions will be great.
Thanks to both of y'all. I'd like to open the floor though for questions.
Not from my conversations with the Department of Health. They really didn't know when I started telling them, you have one county that has exponentially more cases. They were a little bit surprised of it myself. And they were a little bit as surprised as I was myself. I would like to check that with physical environment, because the environment does vary between the counties, to see if that may have an impact as well. But great question. Thank you.
So, particularly with Lyme disease and a lot of communities, there's a huge gap between
That's an excellent question. Based upon the data that we got, I actually originally asked for whatever dates they had, but onset date was the closest date they actually reported consistently to what the actual event date was of transmission, because the other dates we were missing significant amounts. They didn't report a date. So that's why we just had to choose onset date.
So it's not really the data that's reported to a county or state public health official?
Yeah. Because we're basically using the data that was reported to Rhode Island, to the Department of Health. Thank you for your question.
Yeah.
Two questions.
The cases that you counted, were they with Western blood, or were they just doctors' clinical diagnosis?
They followed the state guidelines for confirmation of Lyme disease. I'm assuming it's based on the nationally notified disease surveillance by the CDC. Since it is a nationally notifiable disease, I'm assuming that they're following the same guidelines as far as confirmed the probable cases. I'm not going to put myself on that island and swear by it, but I'm going to go with that. I agree with you entirely. There's a lot of issues with Lyme disease testing among different states. And I mean, I'm coming across this as I'm trying to include other states in my model, that they do vary on different things. And I've been told by other public health state officials that there's a lot of issues with Lyme disease testing.
The other thing that really disturbs me is I think most states have adopted a reporting that Lyme disease has become reportable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if you've got some physicians who are not reporting cases, whether they're clinical diagnoses or verified by CDC Western blot, it could really skew your epidemiology if some of them are not reporting.
That is absolutely true. And I mean, again, this is an early look into the potentially what can go into a model, and these are definitely issues that I need to that we should address as we prefer, move forward. So definitely thank you for letting me know about that, and just I knew a little bit about Lyme disease testing, but not exclusively a lot. Thank you so much. In the back. Yeah. At the moment, I haven't really looked at and compared it with the actual case definitions, because I know case definitions change with time, and the CDC constantly updates them periodically. It would be good to actually to do that as well, and to actually look at how much was confirmed based on that year's current case definition. That's a great question, and hopefully we can pursue that more in the future as well. Thank you. Go ahead. Well, based upon the prior research that we have looked at, temperature, I can talk about temperature because that's the one I remember off the top of my head. They said that warmer temperature a year and a half ago increases the activity of a white-footed mouse, which is often considered the intermediate vector in Lyme disease. So when the activity increases, they're gathering more food, and then they're obviously, if they gather more food, hopefully they're reproducing and increasing in number. That's the theory. As far as ticks, an excess amount of rainfall at certain periods can affect their questing behaviors, which then if they're not able to quest, this can adversely affect, especially adults, if they're not able to quest, this can adversely affect how successful they are at reproducing later on. can I get her first before jumping back to you? Thank you.
So you mentioned about
Yes. That's the question. I mean, as you know, I mean, I'm hoping to, as you know, like modeling future and really getting into that question of climate change, I'm hoping to learn a little bit more about how to model it correctly. And again, at the moment, I don't want to really say I would use this technique because, you know, I look back on it in 5 months and realize, hey, you're pretty wrong there. You shouldn't have said that. So, but it is something I'm hoping to achieve once I learn the proper techniques at possibly modeling what this will be in the future and the effect climate will have on tick-borne diseases.
Okay, let's thank the Ashraf. And I know it's been a lot of interest, so we'll have some time at the end for some more questions. So please save them. We won't let them go anywhere. Okay, for our next speaker, aging-related changes in physical, emotional, and memory-related health and the importance of interacting with animals among community-dwelling older adults. We're sort of switching from the disease aspect that we've been focused on a lot here. Catherine Anthony is a National Science Foundation, and this is the longest fellowship I've ever seen in my life. Okay, let's just say what she said. I'll go ahead and read it. It is interesting. It's Integrative Graduate Education and Research, Training Healthy Aging Sciences Graduate Fellow. Wow. And Doctorate Candidate in Public Health at Oregon State University. Catherine focuses on minority older adult health, informal family caregivers, and health monitoring technology. She is an animal lover. That's good. You're always welcome. And spends much of her free time being trained by her African gray parrot sidekick. Thank you.